Good morning. Welcome to the First Unitarian Church of Alton. My name is Joy Heft. I welcome you into this community of hope and transcendence. Here we seek wisdom beyond our own experience. Here we open our loving minds to the mystery of wonder and the moral imagination. Here we transcend the day-to-day of our lives to seek for truths, both meaningful and sustaining. Here we seek to offer a loving message that provides wholeness in a broken world. We are Unitarian Universalists. We welcome you and invite first-time visitors to fill out one of the visitor cards found in the back of your gray hymnal. If you place it in the offering plate or give it to an usher, we'll send you our church newsletter for the next 3 months to let you know about the programs and activities going on here at the church. We are glad you are here and hope to see you again on future Sundays. We do have a nursery for infants and young children under the age of 4. Through these doors and to the left in the first room past the foyer, older children are asked to join us in our service. At the front, we have a spirit chair, which includes activities for all ages. You are invited to go to the spirit chair at any time during the service to take an activity back to your seat. We welcome everyone into this home of comfort, spirit, justice, and hope. And I have one announcement from Paul Hebert. I have two. The Romeos, retired old men eating out, will meet as usual for lunch and conversation this coming Thursday, August 11th, at the Best Buffet in Wood River. You needn't be retired or old to attend. And from Mary Johnson, we will be having a cleanup workday on Saturday, August 20th, to tidy up the building prior to our church New Year startup. We will be working from 9:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. So if you can give at least an hour or so between those times, please come to share the workload. A list of needed tasks will be available for you to choose from. And now Robin.
Okay, I remind the congregation that we will meet next Sunday at the same time, 10:15 is the beginning of the service, but the Sunday after that, we'll start on a 10 o'clock schedule. And I wish to share something personal with the congregation. There's a new joy coming into my life. Starting this week and for the next 9 months, I will have two wonderful exchange students from the countries of Georgia and Kenya. They will live with me while attending Edwardsville High School. And Julia from Georgia is with me today. Wave your hand, Julia. And next week, with only about 2 or 3 days to get over her jet lag, Nicole will arrive from Kenya. So I ask that you welcome Julia after the service in true UU joy and welcoming. And I want you to know that this is really going to solve a lot of my problems because I can't sit around and worry about the bad news in the world when I've got teenagers to talk to. Okay, now let's see where we are. Yes, we begin our worship with a call to worship.
We are Unitarian Universalists with minds that think, hearts that love, and hands that are ready to serve. We try to see beyond the horizon and, as Greg Greenway sings, to do what must be done. But it is not always easy.
Okay, I need volunteers to enact the chalice lighting words. Do we have anybody who's really good at this? Hello. Okay, Isabella, come on up. And I need a chalice lighter. Okay. We light this chalice, symbol of Unitarian Universalism, May it remind us of the divine spark in all of creation, the part of love to heal what is broken, and to be grateful for life's blessings each day. Someday I'll get that memorized. Thank you, Michael. Okay, we move on with hymn number 1003, Where Do We Come From? Nicole's going to play a brief introduction so we all get on the right key.
We take time to recognize the joys and sorrows, the celebrations and struggles of this community. We do this by taking a stone from the stone or stones from the bowls at the back of our worship space or from the bowl here on the chancel. We allow the stones to bring us into awareness of those things that are most important in our life through thought or meditation. We then place them in the cleansing waters of the community, which includes a little water collected from our annual water communion. If you have joys, sorrows, celebrations, or struggles you wish to recognize, you are invited to come forward now in the ritual of joy and sorrow.
Nicole, will you lead us into singing Comfort Me?
Thank you.
morning's combined reading and meditation is part of a beautiful, thoughtful, painful, and profoundly patriotic poem by one of my favorite Americans, Langston Hughes. Hughes was an African-American poet, novelist, and playwright who helped shape the Harlem Renaissance. He lived between, I think, 1902 and sometime in the 1960s. He wrote this very long poem, all of which is worth reading, called Let America Be America Again. And I'm just going to read a few selections from it. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain, seeking a home where he himself is free. America was never America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be that great, strong land of love, where never kings connive, nor tyrants scheme, that any man be crushed by one above. It was never America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriotic wreath, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. See, makes me cry all the time. There's never been equality for me, says Langston Hughes, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? Oh, I'm the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home. For I'm the one who left dark Ireland's shore and Poland's plain and England's grassy lea, and torn from black Africa's strand I came to build a homeland of the free. The free? Who said the free? Not me. For all the dreams we've dreamed and all the songs we've sung and all the hopes we've held and all the flags we've hung, the millions who have nothing for our pay except the dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet and yet must be. The poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America, whose sweat and blood, whose flesh and pain, whose hand at the foundry, whose plow in the rain, must bring back our mighty dreams again. Okay, here's our offering. Would you read our offering reading together? Tom, can you flip to the next slide? I think I've forgotten something. Excuse me. Our spiritual lives are filled up. Our hearts are warmed by the giving of time, talents, love, comfort, and our many other human resources. We each receive from this church the opportunity to explore meaning, purpose, and value in our lives. How does the financial contribution you make here reflect what you receive? How does our collective money transform those within and beyond our congregation's walls? This morning's offering will be most sincerely and gratefully received. May it be lovingly given. Thank you.
please join us in reciting the offering blessing. To the work of the church, which is weaving a tapestry of love we call community, we dedicate ourselves and these our offerings.
This congregation's mission statement is up on the wall. We see it many Sundays. It reaches the heart of our shared struggle to live our UU principles in the world. It begins with an ethos. Sounds very simple, but it's pretty complicated. Outward reaching, inward seeking. Although there are multiple ways to define those terms, I think in terms of our seven UU principles. Inward seeking relates to two of those principles, our efforts at spiritual growth and the search for truth and meaning. Outward reaching, though, reflects pretty much five of our principles: the worth and dignity of every human being, justice, equity, and compassion, the right of free conscience, and democracy in the way we govern our church, our interests and goals of world community and peace, and the interdependent web of human and all existence on this earth and the universe. So today I want to focus on the joys and sorrows of the outward reaching. Every Sunday as we read that mission statement, I take real joy and comfort in memories of a life that was often devoted to outward reaching. I am grateful for the wonderful, interesting, gracious, honorable people with whom I have had the good fortune to work and live. Those include poor Dominican Pitt families that you might call squatters, but that's a fairly pejorative term. They are people who have built their shanties on land that they didn't own and never could have the right to own. Middle-class Catholic schoolgirls who didn't even know those poor families were there, but we got them working together. Illiterate but enthusiastic adult learners on the flatlands of Richmond, California, where I taught the Laubach Each One Teach One method. It was wonderful to work with people who wanted to read and couldn't, and who really, really cared to be able to learn. The Cambodian immigrants who lived with me in Virginia for years as they learned to cope with the challenges of life in a new country. My ESL students from Sudan, Egypt, Haiti, Costa Rica, and Southeast Asia. Think about what a wonderful, enriching experience that is. And the working class college students with whom I, at the age of 60, worked, going door to door, working for good African American candidates, and so many other people that I remember. Looking at that on Sunday morning makes me happy to remember that. These warm memories make me appreciate anew that life, in my life, has in many ways been blessed. But as in all of life, for all of us, there's a stressful and negative side to that outward reaching that simply and sometimes outweighs the joys. And I want to talk about that because I think I've identified something that really bothers me about this society and where we're going. And I want to share with you some thoughts about it. For years, I have worked and interacted with public servants, committed UUs, and political activists. And I've found that many of us who emphasize outward reaching can sometimes find ourselves in a pretty unhappy state. There are two main ways that outward reaching can sometimes be a burden to our souls. First, obviously, the things we're working on, the problems we're trying to solve, the suffering that we're trying to ameliorate, that's hard to solve. And it often appears to be multiplying, at least lately to me. And that can be discouraging, not only for those who are living with the problems, but those who are trying to change and solve those problems. And in many cases, like with the Black Lives Matter people, they're both living with it and trying to solve it. If we devote our professional lives to righting the wrongs of the world or caring for the afflicted, either as teachers or counselors or police or corrections officers or anybody, then we might sometimes experience depression and anxiety. And I've always admired the people who work in mental health, knowing that I couldn't do that because it would be such a strain to deal with other people's problems like that, even though it's rewarding. So, whatever our circumstances, if we are to treat each other with respect, then those discouragements and stresses must be heard and acknowledged. Now, the second way that I think outward reaching can be a stressful on some of us is that we feel an obligation to know about our society and to be responsible in a civic way, to vote responsibly. We feel an obligation to help other people and know what's happening to other people. We simply care, and that often leads us into paying attention to the news. Well, has anybody paid attention to the news lately? I mean, I watched the Republican and the Democratic conventions, and I actually had a nightmare about it that caused me to fall out of bed and get a black and blue eye. I mean, that was really bad news. And there are thinkers in the world who look at our news media, like a French philosopher that I kind of like, named Alain de Botton. He's not a heavy-duty philosopher. He's not an academic writer. He tries and likes to popularize his ideas and get people to think more. And he wrote a little book called The News, A User's Guide. Very short book. But it's very erudite. It has a lot of information in it. It has a lot of ideas about what's wrong and what's right about our news media and what could be better. And what he observes, and he's not the only one, says our news media is driving us crazy. Paula LaFond made a comment about 2 months ago on Facebook in which she said, "We are drowning in facts, but we're crazy. It's making us crazy. We don't know how to deal with it." And she's very right. What worries me is not that the news, not just that the news can make us as individuals a little bit unhappy or skew our view of the people around us. It also is contributing, I believe, largely to the destruction of our civic life. With the exception of National Public Radio and public television, most of the time, it's the other media that caused the problem for me. Just think about cable news, what people say about politics on Facebook, tweets, not very constructive lately, and all the other online social media, and the way the print media deal with news. Okay, straight news can be bad enough. I mean, if you're paying attention to what goes on in the world, tsunamis, you know, police attacks on people who are unarmed, all those kinds of stories can be very depressing no matter how they're told. But if you don't deal with the stuff in a way that has meaning and depth, and if you allow people to use the media to get across their own negative political messages, it can be really skew our view of the world we live in, of the nature of our country, of the people that are our country. Thank God that we have each other and that we have friends outside that can help offset the ideas that the media can give to us. Think how much large and influential segments of today's media focus on inviting people who do finger-pointing, complaining, blaming, scapegoating, and avoiding responsibility. And they give them a megaphone and they come back. And very often, the reporters that are interviewing these people don't challenge them and don't provide any context. Many observers argue that the media pay too much attention to the acts and the attitudes that contradict our own American best values, and they no longer hold up the vision that Langston Hughes held up. Now, in spite of the fact that Langston Hughes said that America was not that to him, he still believed in that, in those ideals, didn't he? He wouldn't be lamenting that if he didn't care about it. If we compare Langston Hughes' vision of the America that never was to what we get, to the story we get in the media, the contrast is almost painful. Many Americans used to think that we were moving in the right direction. As you probably know, if you're paying attention to the polls, a lot of Americans, most Americans, think we are not moving in the right direction. Many of us, whether we're right, center, or left politically, are becoming less sanguine that the arc of history really is moving toward justice or progress. Carl Jung, Deepak Chopra, and many others have observed that human nature has its good side and its bad side, its shadow side. Chopra, in commenting on the current state of American politics, observed this, and I quote, "The shadow compounds all the dark impulses, hatred, aggression, sadism, selfishness, jealousy, resentment, sexual transgression, that are usually hidden out of sight." The name The Shadow originated with Carl Jung, but its basic origin came from Freud. Freud observed that our psyches are sort of dualistic, sharply divided between the conscious and the unconscious. Now, there's a lot of studies in brain science that kind of challenge Freud nowadays, but the idea that there's a good side and a bad side to human nature is pretty well agreed on in some form or another by a lot of people who think about these things. Chopra says, "The rise of civilization is a tribute to how well we obey our conscious mind and suppress our unconscious mind." I don't know about that, but there's a little truth to it. "What hides in the shadows will out," he says. When that which hides in the shadows does out, societies that look well-ordered and rational, fair and just, cultured and refined, suddenly erupt in horrible displays of everything they are not about. How many times have you heard our president say, when he's lamenting some murder or some chaos, "That's not what America is about"? Violence, prejudice, chaos, and ungovernable irrationality do erupt. And in fact, Chopra says, and I'm not sure if this is true, but it's something to think about. He says, "The tragic irony is that the worst eruptions of the shadow occur in societies that on the surface have the least to worry about." Think about Germany in the late 20s and 30s. A lot of horrible things happened in public life then and thereafter, but Germany was one of the most civilized countries in Western history. It had Beethoven, Bach, and Brahms. You know, it had all this wonderful literature and philosophy. And yet what was done was beyond the pale of civilization. It could happen to us. Our media play to the shadow. It brings listeners. Too rarely do they play to the American dream or anything resembling UU principles. And they fail their responsibility to contribute to a healthy national dialogue, which is why the Constitution protects the freedom of the press in the first place. Our founders protected freedom of the press because they thought the media were going to contribute to us making more intelligent discussions. Now, they weren't totally ignorant. They knew we were going to have political press on one side and political press on another side and that kind of thing. But they knew that we needed something that would get us talking about serious issues. Civilization is a thin veneer. Now, I don't believe that disasters like Katrina and what else can we think about? Tsunamis and any other disaster that would happen to us alone can destroy this society. But what can really weaken us is the way it's communicated, the way we communicate about those disasters, and how we react to them. Katrina was an example of us not reacting very well as a nation, for example. Okay, how do the news media tend to skew our picture of the world we live in and of what is doable? Well, first of all, it's what they choose. They very rarely choose to spend an awful lot of time on a new battery that's going to be cheap and help us solve our energy problems and reduce costs. They spend instead time on a scandal, accusing somebody of bribery and corruption when there's really no grounds, spending millions of dollars to investigate scandals that really aren't, and that kind of thing. In addition, the second way that the media can skew our view of the world and affect our faith and our hope and our belief and our love for other people is the way they treat the media, the scandals and stories they've decided to cover. Reverend Sunshine talked a couple months ago about catastrophizing. Psychologists often use the word horribleizing. You know, something happens to you and you make it worse than it is. You lament it. You complain to your friends. You put an article on Facebook. You say, isn't this awful? And you make it worse. The media encourages that. They think they get more listeners if they make us afraid, if they tell us the world is falling apart. Well, how many times can you be told the world is falling apart without beginning to think that maybe it's right? Another thing that the media do for us, ever since particularly the 24-hour news cycle, is they repeat things. Now, I'll bet everyone in here knows that you have to repeat things in order to learn them. If you have studied for a test, you know, or for an interview, you know you've got to repeat things in order to learn them. But repetition of things that are not true works just as well as repetition of things that are true. Some media studies have found that when you put graphic violence on a movie, in a movie or on television, that in some people that creates symptoms of PTSD. That's pretty extreme. Other studies show that there's a rising anxiety and depression in many sectors of our society. And I attribute some of that to the way the news media tend to scare us to death. And the politicians and the business people who go on television tend to scare us to death. Okay, when Allison and her brother were little, they studied violin with the Suzuki method. And Suzuki had an interesting insight. I think Isabella is studying viola, right? Yeah. And Suzuki had an interesting insight. There's an old saying, practice makes perfect, right? Suzuki said that's not true. Practice makes permanent. And if you practice wrong, you learn it wrong. If you practice sawing at your violin like this, you're not going to be able to learn to play it like this because you teach your body to do it wrong. So you got to be careful that what you are repeating, what you are practicing, is something that's right, that's good, that's helpful. So repetition and the twisting of lies are key elements, as you probably know, of propaganda. Joseph Goebbels talked about the big lie. He knew that repetition over and over again can make us believe things that we don't want to believe. I mean, I find myself feeling negative about a particular national political character sometimes, and when I ask myself why, I realize I can't particularly say why. I've just heard a lot of allegations and heard a lot of sneers and a bad tone of voice on television and radio media. Another thing is that our brains play tricks on us. I find this fascinating. If you listen to something repeated 5 or 10 times on the same source, let's say you're working in the local cleaners and they have these television sets up there to entertain people while they're waiting in line, and the television is always tuned to one particular station. If you hear that over and over again during the day, 2 weeks later, you will forget that you heard it from one source and think that you really heard it from 10 sources. What does that do? It tends to make you think that, quote, everybody knows this. And those people who don't know this are either fools or they're malevolent. Another thing that's interesting that brain studies have shown recently is that if you hear something that you know is from an unreliable source, you know that you don't know whether this person is trustworthy, you're not familiar with that website, or you know that it's a politically biased website, or a pro-business or an anti-business website, or a pro-anarchistic website, you know that you take it a little bit, but you question it. You ought to be skeptical. You ought to check out those facts with another source. But 2 weeks after that, if you go back and test people who've heard that, they have forgotten that they were initially skeptical about the source. And they've just absorbed the information and they think that it's true. So I think that that kind of activity inside our brains that's totally subconscious is really being tapped into by people who have very strong intents to propagandize us. Let's see. Oh, another thing is the free megaphone. I've never understood why it's easier to get on television. Well, no, I guess I do understand why. It's easier to get on television when you've got something negative to say about a politician or a business leader or some movie star or something like that than it is if you are a serious businessman trying to develop a new product that will make the lives of people a lot easier. And I think part of it is that people who want to manipulate television and manipulate people through television and radio, they present themselves to the news stations. They call up the news stations. They offer to appear for free. And when you treat news as a profit center, rather than the way we used to treat it, as a loss leader, and we subsidized it with entertainment advertising, when you treat the news as a profit center, you're going to try to cut down all expense. And it's expensive to do investigative journalism. It's expensive to go out and find the best expert on a particular important issue and invite them in and pay for their travel expenses. It's much easier to get some congressman or whoever who's right there and offering himself, and it's available, and the technology is available to interview him indirectly. It's easy. Do you guys remember what, 40 years ago or so, I'm showing how old I am, when on television they interviewed people who really knew what was going on in a particular poverty program, or they were academics, you know, or they had traveled, or they were ambassadors. Now who's interviewed on the news? One reporter interviews another reporter. Well, that's not to say that that other reporter doesn't have some knowledge. He has been working at getting to know people, but it's not direct knowledge. And the guy doesn't have any academic training, and the guy hasn't actually worked in the field that we're asking about. So there's a big difference, I think, in the way the media are approaching things like that. Another thing that fascinates me, you guys remember Nate Silver? Have you heard the name of Nate Silver? He was extremely much praised in the media for having called practically every state and national election in 2008 being right. He's a statistician who started out loving baseball and paying attention to baseball statistics. And he applied some of his techniques to politics and was very successful. Well, he wrote a little book called The Signal and the Noise about how we tend to pay attention to the noise, to the wrong kinds of information and the wrong kinds of data, and we miss the signal. And among the other things he said was that statisticians, PhDs who spend their lives measuring and figuring the odds and the likelihood of different things, themselves, when they have the data they need on a particular important public issue, still overestimate danger. They overestimate, for example, what are the chances of being killed by terrorism in this country? Not nearly as high as the chances of being hit by a car, and what about a plane crash? Plane crashes, not nearly as much as being hit by a car or getting sick or something like that, or falling down the stairs. But we tend to be worried about these things that statistically don't merit it. Why? Well, think about it. Back when we lived out in caves or in the savanna, and we hunted woolly mammoths, and we were chased by saber-toothed tigers, how did you live? If you, one, noticed the unusual, that had survival value. If you didn't notice the unusual and just paid attention to what was immediately around you, you might get eaten. Through eons of evolution, we learn to overestimate danger. The person who overestimates the likelihood of getting killed is likely to be more careful. So he's likely to survive. His genes are likely to survive. If he underestimates danger back in an environment like that, he's going to get eaten. So we have a human propensity that's been developed over thousands of years to overestimate risk. That tends to lead us into situations where we can make ourselves sick by overestimating risk. And if the media play into it, and our political leaders play into it, and our economic leaders play into it, we can have a whole society versus people that are just slowly and quietly going crazy because we're getting a story that's not healthy for us and that is not conducive to hope and is not conducive to faith. So let me give you an example of the last thing that I think the media do that makes life difficult for us and that challenges our faith and that challenges our hope and our sense and our willingness to work. Just imagine in your mind, make a picture of the mighty Mississippi River. It starts out as a couple of springs up in Minnesota somewhere, and the springs bubble up and they form pools. People can walk across the Mississippi stepping on stones. Yes, Mary says she's done it. I've done it too. It's exciting. Well, that water gathers together, forms a bigger river. Maybe a tree falls in the river, or what are those animals? I've forgotten. With the beavers, with the big tails. They make a beaver dam, and it changes the flow of the water. And over eons, there may be earthquakes that change the land, which changes the flow of the rivers. Glaciers melt or recede, and that changes the amount of water flowing into the rivers. The river gets wider. Other rivers join it. Pretty soon, humans come along. We invent pesticides. The pesticides, you know, enter the river and changes the water. Pleasure boats can be seen on the Mississippi. Big barges and tugboats, but they can't get all the way down to New Orleans unless we build locks and dams. And I bet most of you know, but I'm going to show Julia sometime soon, the big locks and dams between here and Wood River. It's the biggest along the Mississippi. We build canals, like the canal down in St. Louis. That river has people in it, working on it, fishing, servicing boats, doing all kinds of things. And over the long reach of history, the river changes. Now let's say some night the local news drives a van up to the shore of the Mississippi. The videographer drops out, jumps out of the van, gets his equipment. A handsome reporter steps out and stands, you know, with the river in the background. And the videographer shoots, 30 seconds or a minute worth of commentary about some local problem or some local scandal. And they go home and they put it on the news. Well, look, how much does that 30-second slice of the river at one moment in time and at one place, with a topic that maybe isn't a very in-depth, serious topic, tell us about the nature of that whole river that surrounds the history? The news is like that. It's too often, I think, and so does Alain de Botton and some of the other commentators, gives us a little slice of reality, but doesn't tell us the context. It doesn't tell us anything about that beautiful, magnificent river, how it has changed, how important it is, what humans have done with it, why we need it to survive, how we are abusing it, what the future might be. It gives us this little piece. Now that's important. Maybe those of us who are really well educated and who care a lot about the environment, we can understand that story. But think about other complex political and economic stories like the minimum wage, whether the Social Security retirement age ought to be raised, other things like that that are really important and affect us. But now let's imagine you're somebody who doesn't specialize in government, who even has been taught that government is bad. And you watch a 30-second coverage of the minimum wage and you think, I'm 22. I've got to get a job. I've got to support myself. Why do I care about that? You know, or somebody talks about the serious problems that some people in a very poor neighborhood are having. And a person who doesn't live there, who doesn't know those people, who doesn't understand that the issue may be nationwide or worldwide, doesn't understand it. Now, another thing I just want to mention about this is that, I lost my thought. That'll do, I'll quit. I'll quit. But I want you to understand, I want to get across to you the idea that at least for me, maybe not for you, you may be really strong and well-centered and mentally healthy and totally able to resist all kinds of propaganda and that kind of stuff. But at least for me, I'm very disappointed in what our media do. And I think our media could give us a much better sense of context for what they're reporting. And people would be more interested if they had a better context. We get that sometimes on National Public Radio and public television. But even they are getting more and more interrupted by ads, and their choice of topics to cover are being influenced by who sponsors them, like Archer Daniel Midland sponsored the McNeil Lehrer Hour, and for years while they were sponsoring that, you never heard complaints about agribusiness on their coverage. So even the wonderful public television and public radio stations are suffering now. And having worked in budgeting for state government, I know that all over the country, states are cutting their financial support for public radio and television, and so is the federal government. So someday we may not even have that. So I just, you know, like to close with the idea that this is a wonderful country with wonderful ideals, but our media are doing us a great disservice by ignoring those ideals and not ever seriously providing an offset to some of the negativism that's coming to us. And I have decided that the way I solve my problems with getting depressed, at least for the next year, I'm not watching MSNBC anymore. And I certainly am not watching CNN and Fox. I'm going to spend my time with Julia and Nicole and reading and listening to music and stuff like that. I can't take any more of this media. But one day, I think I'm going to get enough energy up to start writing letters to the local media and to the letters to the editor and say, look, you guys can do better. Please change this. Don't put the worst people in our society on television. Don't focus on scandal. Give us more depth. It's killing a lot of people's enthusiasm and respect for our national institutions. And it's hurting a lot of individuals, and it's hurting the country. So I realize there are other ways to look at this, but this has been something that's been bothering me for years. And during convention season and presidential campaign, it's just escalating. So let us think about what we could do to make our media better. And let us close with singing a hopeful, happy song that we all love, Blue Boat Home. Okay?
Please rise.
please be seated. Having been a pianist in a younger life, I am amazed that Nicole can play that piece and turn the pages at the same time. I say, that's great, Nicole, thank you. Someday you maybe should get somebody to turn pages for you. Let us take our shared values and our hopes, and let us carry them consciously into our work week so that we can help America be the dream it was meant to be, and so that we can carry out the part of the mission statement that tells us to reach outward. Until we meet again, let's remember the hope.